Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Milwaukee native, cartoonist, animator, and author Paul Noth has reached a lot of different audiences in his career, from TV viewers of Conan O'Brien and Saturday Night Live to erudite print readers in the pages of The New Yorker and The Wall Street Journal, and now discerning middle grade readers.
Noth's new book is the first in a trilogy. It is called How to Sell Your Family to the Aliens. Noth is back in Wisconsin this week for a series of school visits, but he joined us in the studio as well. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about your career path. How did you go? I gather you are a product of MPS?
Yes. I'm K through 12, MPS schools the entire time. I just visited my high school. I'm coming directly from there, from Rufus King High. You know, always interested in cartoons. But that was a distraction. That wasn't actually my studies. I didn't think that I would, you know, luck out enough to get to do that for a living. And loved writing, too. Loved books and literature, and thinking I'd be a writer, I went to Emerson College in Boston after King, and there I pursued literary fiction for a while, but always loved to draw, and drew in my spare time, filled up notebooks with my cartoons.
What were the cartoons you were reading when you were young?
I loved Calvin and Hobbes. I loved Charles Schulz, Peanuts. I really had everything. I would scour every public library for every cartoon. Anything that was a cartoon, I was familiar with. My father, who was the film critic for the Journal and feature editor, he'd bring me home sometimes. Cartoon books would come across the feature desk, and he'd bring them home for me. And that was a great era for cartoon books. So I was familiar with The New Yorker. I was familiar with, you know, it was a much bigger field in those days of all the newspaper comics and stuff like that. And so, but my favorite was probably Charles Schulz, and then a little bit later, Calvin and Hobbes.
It's interesting. I remember interviewing Mo Willems years ago, and he talked about getting into cartooning thanks to Charles Schulz. And his thought was, thank heavens that Peanuts was so relatively simple to draw, because he could draw his version of Peanut strips when he was in fourth grade.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that. I was doing third grade is exactly right. I was copying Peanuts and trying to perfect them. That's another thing. I know Mo, and that's another thing that we have in common is that I didn't realize that. But, I think it's pretty common among cartoonists of our generation because it was an entire world you could just get lost in. You know, it was like an epic novel, incredibly funny, very simple, too.
You mentioned the idea that you were just in this, the world of cartoons was huge in those days. And I don't know exactly how old you are, but it seems like about the same era that I grew up in. When you go to a school today, you just came from Rufus King, you're going to Trowbridge in a little while, you're going to spend the day on Tuesday going to schools in Oconomowoc. Do you see are kids immersed in cartoons the same way today that they were when you were a kid?
I think so. It's a different world. It's a digital world. My question for them is not, have you heard of The New Yorker magazine? It's have you heard of magazines? There is a whole world of online cartoons, and a lot of what they think of as cartoons is animation, because that's much big. I loved animation as a kid, but it was few and far between. You had to get up on Saturday morning. You had to get you had to let your mom turn on the TV after school to watch Bugs Bunny, which was really my favorite thing in the universe, were those Bugs Bunny cartoons. Animation is much more widespread, but it's looking at my nieces and nephews, it's amazing how popular comics are right now, like comic books, anime. What isn't, my favorite thing as a kid was the sort of short joke form. And that is, while it's, in corners of the web, there's very good work being done. That's not as big as it was. But, comics are huge, and anime is just huge, So it's out there, just sort of in a slightly different form.
And I feel like I cut you off in your description of your career path, because the last we heard, you were working in literary fiction.
Yes.
And and then somehow you went from drawing in notebooks to actually doing it for a living.
Yeah, that was very surprising to me because I was, you know, I was aware of The New Yorker from a very early age. And I sort of wrote it off at that early age, too, because I knew I watched it and I paid attention and I saw – I knew not just by reputation, but I saw, you know, that it was always the same people, you know, and that it was really hard to break in. And so I never thought I would be a New Yorker cartoonist. And I was living in New York and I began writing comedy. And there was a comedy show in New York called The Rejection Show. And it's everyone takes their rejected material and, you know, that you perform it or you show it. And so it was at that comedy show that I met Matt Diffie, a New Yorker cartoonist. And I showed him some of my cartoons. And he was like, you know, we're trying to bring in new people. It's, you know, it's Bob Mankoff, when he took over as editor, he was like, this art form is not going to survive unless we bring in more. So, you know, now, you know, under Bob, it was, you know, you started to see about 10 new people every year, whereas before I felt like it was like 10 new people every decade, you know. So that gave me my chance. And Matt sort of looked at my stuff and gave me feedback and said what Bob would hate and why. So he taught me how to do the weekly batches, 10 cartoons a week. And, you know, if you have the best week ever, you will sell one, you know. So they're probably all going to get rejected. Then they invited me to come to the Tuesday Look meeting. You know, and that was the beginning of it for me.
What was the first one that was accepted of yours?
The first one, I really lucked out because I sold for my first batch, which is really unusual. And it was right during the Iraq War. And it was a White House press secretary, and he's holding a flashlight under his face, like a kid or like a campsite. And the press person is saying, how do you respond to critics who say you're just trying to scare people? and so I really, you know, that I was not expecting to sell from my first batch. And so, you know, and I was off and running. And getting that validation from The New Yorker, you know, I was hooked.
I've interviewed a number of people who, you know, draw regular comic strips, and we've talked about, you know, sort of how far in advance they're submitted and how the editorial process works. But how does the process work for The New Yorker even after they've accepted a panel, which I gather has to be a lot more, you know, rapid turnaround than
yes.
what somebody drawing 3 months in advance for a strip
yes.
that's going to run in the newspaper will be?
Well, you know, sometimes they want it immediately. You know, and we're sending in roughs. We're sending in what's suggested is 10 roughs a week, different ideas. And sometimes they're topical and they want them right away. And sometimes some of them are supposed to be evergreen and timeless.
The How's Waldo one, for
right,
example.
Yeah, as long as Waldo's around, right. You know, that one might work. It all depends. And so I will do, you know, if. Sometimes I'll take a week to get it in. Sometimes I'll have to turn it around overnight, you know.
And how much editorial guidance are you getting?
Yeah, you know, not that much. Especially when Bob was editor, and even now with Emma Allen as the new editor, he was a very big believer in letting us find our own voice and our own sensibility. And he thought that he would give us advice that was, you know, his ethic was find your own voice, find your own way to do this. So, you know, which is great, but his advice would be sort of maddeningly vague because of that. Like, keep working on this, you know, keep working on the art. This is just okay, you know. And it was a great mixture of encouragement and just, you know, like cold-hearted rejection at the same time.
Just kind of like life, really.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Bob Mankoff is a lot like life.
How often do you go to the Tuesday Look meetings?
You know, I haven't been in a while. I really went when Bob was sort of getting to know me and the magazine was getting to know me. And I think that's when it was important to go. And I could kind of feel him out and get a sense of what he liked that I was doing and what, you know. And he was sort of my champion there. He really – he spotted something, you know, in my cartoons early on. And, like, he really encouraged me. But over time, you know, I start to wonder – you know, they like my cartoons. Me showing up in person, I could just mess it up, you know. So, you know, I began doing more just emailing, you know, after a while. But I drop in when I can and see, you know, it's a sort of, you know, a group of cartoonists there. It's a great sort of – it's great to complain with people who have to, you know, go through the same thing you do.
What sparked the move to middle grade fiction?
I was interested in doing something like that for a while. I grew up loving Roald Dahl, and I always kind of wanted – I was thinking like something along those lines. And, you know, I work a lot in notebooks and I kind of work stream of consciously. I'm not sure if something's going to be a single panel cartoon or an idea for an animated piece or an idea for something longer. And it was in a notebook, How to Sell Your Family to the Aliens. And I forgot when I even wrote that. And I just in front of it, I drew the kid counting money. And then I wrote the first line, which was, before you assume I'm a bad person, you should know that I had originally only planned on selling my grandma to the aliens, not my whole family. And I liked that voice, you know. And then it just sort of sat there. And then through my work in The New Yorker, I was contacted by an agent who said, do you have anything for middle graders? And I said, maybe. And so I just sort of picked that up again and wrote a couple chapters. And I sent it to her, and she became my agent and said, finish this. And, you know, and then she's sort of guided the process ever since.
And thus Hap Conklin Jr. was born.
Yes, exactly. That's the birth of Hap Conklin Jr.
There is something about an audience that reads a book and then rereads a book and then reads it a third time and a fourth time and then has their parents say, do you not have other books?
Yeah.
It's not like that with – I mean, you know, I might look at a New Yorker cartoon and find it funny and then show it to my wife who also finds it funny. But that's probably where I leave it.
Yes. Yeah, I think that, you know, there's something about that when, you know, when a kid attaches to a story, you know, that becomes the story. And they want to see it again and again and again. And I remember stories like that from when I was a kid. And, you know, and it's becomes very important. You know, and so that's why it's really, you know, seeing all these kids responding to the book really just blows my mind. You know,
I was going to ask about that because you probably don't get the same kind of feedback. You know, you probably get a lot of complaining feedback sometimes on a New Yorker cartoon. But
yes.
You go to a school and they have devoured this book, and
yes,
the feedback is a little different.
Yeah, that was, you know, and to see the kids welcoming me, I was in Chicago schools or Chicago area schools all last week, and I was welcomed with huge, amazing artwork of the characters, of, you know, of aliens, of, and they were, you know, and it was that kind of blew my mind. You know, it was just to see them, you know, to see that it got their imagination going and them, and, you know, and they pick right up on the humor, they pick right up on the characters, and so that was fantastic.
What do you think they look for when you go to an event like that? What do they take from you?
I think that it's a wide mix of students, you know, so and everyone is different, you know, so it's a little bit of a new world for me because I'm kind of used to just sort of spinning this stuff off in my own mind and in my own studio. And then I'm in front of some schools, it's third through fifth, some schools it's just fifth, some like sixth graders, and it's all sort of wildly different. And but, you know, I love that they are laughing. You know, that I think is key. I think about myself when I was that age when I'm writing this, and I think about, you know, when it started, I love science fiction. So I think about myself now and I think about, you know, what I want to read now, but then I remind myself, hey, you know, 9-year-old Paul wants to read Mad Magazine, you know, and so then I kind of try to bring it back there, you know, and so it's sort of just the mixture of that. And different kids are really responding to different things from the book.
Visiting a high school, a little different because they're obviously older than the target demographic for the book, but it must be nice to connect with like the school you went to.
Absolutely.
I didn't want to date it, but
yeah, it was way back when.
It's still standing.
It's still there. Yeah, it's still there. And I'm still standing too, barely. And the I was talking to art students and writing students. And so, you know, it sort of was a chance for me to, you know, to talk to that age version of myself and tell them, you know, you know, and sort of talk about my journey through, you know, through the different arts and doing animation and doing writing and doing art and trying so many different things and seeing what connected and seeing, you know, and it was in the same room, actually. I realized once I was giving the talk, it was in the same room where Rufus King has the International Baccalaureate IB program. And it was in the room where I took my IB art exam. And they had all their artwork up. You know, and so I could go after the talk. I went around and I spoke with them about, you know, and it's just really it was so good to see because there's so, you know, there's so much amazing work going on there. And it's, you know, and it was very inspiring. And I hope I sort of gave them a sense of what, you know, of first of all, that this is possible, that you can go on from, you know, you can be from an MPS school and, you know, you can go on and have, you know, your work appreciated and also that it was difficult, you know. And so I feel like I really it was actually a really great time.
When you think about cartooning and doing animation, which you have done, and writing middle grade fiction with illustrations as well, we should say, do they all occupy a slightly different place in your creative life? Do they scratch a slightly different creative itch for you?
I think so. Yes, it's and one of them, you know, lately I'm writing these books. It's a series of three books, and this is the first, and I'm finished the second, and I'm revising it, and I'm thinking about the third. And it is, I mean, writing stories has always been tremendously fun for me. And it's a sort of a different kind of manic energy. And there's all of a sudden, I just want to see what the characters are going to do. I want to see what's going to happen, you know. Single panel joke cartoons are fun, but they're difficult. You know, they're difficult in a different way because they're like a marathon versus a standing long jump. You know, like you just have to do it. And you give yourself some prompts, but it's really just, you know, it's really just you and that piece of paper, and you can't, you know, there's no characters to sort of build energy and have it sustain itself. But, you know, when you get it right, when you get a good one, you know, that's very addictive. That's really fun. So,
well, right. The thing that always strikes me about those single panel strips is that the really good ones, as you look at them, you can kind of, you know, it's incumbent on you to be able to figure out what has just happened before and what the result might be afterwards. You're kind of freezing this funny moment in time.
Yes, and I think the best ones kind of open up a world, you know, and they're surprising because you don't expect something that small to be funny and to resonate like that, you know. So it's because of the limitations of the form and the fact that people are just jumping into them and jumping out of them. You know, they're reading in the New Yorker, it could be they're reading something about, you know, China's economy, and then, you know, they're jumping into your, you know, you have two guys in a bar and you know, like that's the context, you know. So it's you know, they're very challenging, but they're extremely fun. And I've always been like a huge fan. You know, whenever I see a really good one, it just makes me happy in like a very particular way.
Well, Paul Noh, thank you so much for spending some time with us. And best of luck. Hope we'll see you again with book two.
Oh, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
Milwaukee native Paul Noh is a cartoonist whose work regularly appears in The New Yorker. His new book, however, is for middle grade readers, though. It's called How to Sell Your Family to the Aliens. He's in Wisconsin this week for Milwaukee and Oconomowoc school visits organized by Boswell Books and Books & Company.